once again, and welcome to the Image Doctors at Nikonians Talk Radio, a production of podcasts.nikonians.org. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And this is our 50th episode, Rick.
Woohoo!
For September 27th, 2007.
We've been doing this for a while now.
We've been doing this for almost 2 years now.
Yeah.
And we're still alive.
Yeah, people are still listening.
And people keep sending us
surprising
emails.
Number, in fact.
And yeah, and so we're very happy to still be doing this. We're very excited, as we mentioned last time, we're going to be taking off to the ANPAT, Nikonians Annual Photo Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of this week, so where we're going to be.
In fact, we'll be hitting the road a day after this podcast comes out.
Yep, driving up to Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I'm ready.
I am too.
I mean,
psyched.
Mentally I'm ready. I'm not packed, but mentally I'm ready.
No, I'm not even close to packed. But
yep. And I can't wait to get out there
and see the
gang. Yeah, a
whole week of shooting.
Well, and also seeing all the
great
people
spot.
Met over the years. That's really fun. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
We've got a couple of topics today that we've come up with for you. The first one's we're going to do a brief discussion about portrait lenses.
Mm-hmm.
So choosing a lens for portrait work.
Yeah, what makes a good portrait lens? And
by that, we mean portraits of people.
Right.
And we've certainly talked about animal portraits in the past. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to talk about a little bit about the philosophy of developing your own style.
Mm-hmm.
or identifying your style.
Yeah, figuring out, do you have one?
Right.
Yeah, sometimes, we'll talk about this later.
Yeah, but
it's an
interesting topic. Exactly. Yeah. And then we'll, of course, have our weekly photo prescription. So let's start with talking about portrait lenses and what makes a good portrait lens. What are you usually trying to do?
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of portraits, I'm thinking about, most of the time, I'm thinking about a shot where, you know, one or two people, but a nice out-of-focus background.
Right.
So something with shallow depth of field.
And fairly tightly composed, too.
Right. That's kind of how I view a portrait.
Yeah, because you could make a portrait of someone with any lens that you could imagine, and it could be a great shot.
Mm-hmm.
It could be a fisheye, it could be a 500mm telephoto lens, and it could still be a cool shot. So, you know, but what we're going to focus in on are probably the more classic kind of portraits. Right,
traditional mm-hmm. portraits. Because I guess if you put any person in the image, you could call it a portrait.
Mm-hmm.
So now one of the rules I had always learned with when looking for a portrait lens was to try to choose a slightly longer focal length.
Right.
And the reason for that was, the way I learned it was, you don't want to use something too long or too short, because you, especially the shorter focal lengths, because in order to fill the frame with the subject, you start getting funny distortions of facial features. Noses start
right.
looking big, and people
right.
don't like that necessarily.
Right. And that comes from distance rather than, you know, something the lens is really doing.
Right.
And there's kind of an interesting psychological thing that goes along with it. People like viewing photos of people if they're taken at a distance that's a comfortable psychological distance too. In other words, you know, most people and at least in Western cultures don't like getting really close and in someone's face. They like stepping back, and depending on where you're at in the world, that distance will vary a little bit. But I think that often influences the kind of perspective that we typically like in portraits. And so quick little psychology today tidbit.
Well, and then so coming from, we'll start with a discussion of what the traditional focal lengths were for portraits, and those mm-hmm. were things usually in the somewhere between 85 and 135 millimeters
right.
if you're shooting on a film camera or 35 millimeter camera.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of good examples of those, and then with DX lenses, it changes the equation a little bit, and you can use a slightly shorter focal length for the same framing with a DX camera.
Right. And I think this is an area that has never really been resolved for DX format cameras. You know what I mean?
Oh, as to like which
well,
you know, where to, which one to go. Yeah, because when you shoot, if you take a classic portrait lens, we'll throw out, you know, the current top of the heap or one of the top of the heap lenses that people mention for the Nikon mm-hmm. lens is the 85-1.4
right.
AFD. If you put that on a crop body, now you've got something that you can't stand at the same distance. You have to take far. You have to be farther away from the subject.
It still works, but it's just a slightly more awkward distance a lot of times.
And the farther away you are from your subject, the larger the apparent depth of field is. And a lot of times with these portrait lenses, you want to be close enough so that you get that really nice blurred background. Now, obviously, when you're looking for a portrait lens, one of the things that sets all of the lenses that we're going to talk about today, sets them apart is that they all have fairly wide apertures.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking about stuff that's in the f2 or faster range.
Yeah, because just to generalize what makes a lens a good portrait lens, you know, first thing is typical distance that you'll be at, you know, when taking photos of, you know, a single person or a couple people. You're not too close so that you get bad perspective, and you're not too far away that you get very flattened facial perspective, or it's just too awkward in the sense that you're too far away. It's difficult to talk to your subject without shouting, or if you're indoors, you just can't back up far enough. So that's one of the aspects, you know, which relates to focal length, and of course, sensor size can influence that. The other thing is a thing that you were mentioning earlier. What's the quality of the out of focus background?
Mm-hmm.
Is it nicely blurred and not distracting, or is it something that's kind of ugly where you have a lot of double line kind of effects if you don't have a super clean background? And so people will usually gravitate to certain focal lengths and then lenses that produce really nice, clean, simple backgrounds too.
Yeah, and a lot of times some of the newer lens designs with the Nikon lenses, you'll see not only more aperture blades, so instead of 7, they'll have maybe 9 aperture blades.
Because that'll smooth out the background a bit.
And then even some of the fancier lenses, they're actually rounding the aperture blades themselves to render an even nicer out-of-focus appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those, I think like the new 105 macro does that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it has rounded aperture.
I think you're right.
So, but I mean, those are physical properties of the lenses. So let's start, you know, so you have to start by thinking of what kind of situation you'll be in when you're shooting your portraits. For example, like you said, if you're inside, if you have built yourself a studio, there's only so much room that you're going to have. You're going to have physical constraints. A 200 millimeter lens is probably not going to be the way to go. And if you're on a DX body,
It's really not the way to go.
It might be even tough for an 85 millimeter lens, depending on how much space you have. And so then you might want to go to something like a 50 millimeter lens. On the other hand, if you're shooting mostly outdoor pictures, and space isn't an issue, then you can start playing with the 105s or the 135s, or if you're shooting still a film camera, I mean, it all just depends. So those are all good focal lengths. So you want to sort of go down the list of like lenses that we've come up with that are good portrait lenses and talk about them a little bit?
Sure. Do you want to start with the manual focus ones? Because that gives us a little bit of history too, which is kind of a fun thing in a sense.
We've put 2 manual focus lenses, and these are all Nikkor lenses.
Mm-hmm.
We've put 2 on our list. The first one is the 85 F2.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't you tell us a little about what makes that one such a great lens?
It's cheaper than heck. It never had a really outstanding reputation just because of some earlier views that weren't all that kind. But in fact, it works quite well, especially as a portrait lens. It's not quite as contrasty as some other ones that are out there. But that has some virtues, frankly, for portrait work. It reduces facial blemishes and just a little bit nicer look on the skin. So I've actually found that one to work quite well. You know, the one that I have sitting on my shelf, I think I bought for $110 in almost mint condition, you know, ridiculously low. Even if you don't get as great a deal, it's still awfully cheap. Mm-hmm. And it's tiny. It's not much bigger than a 50 millimeter lens. It is just tiny. So it's really pleasant to carry around and, you know, something like an FM2 body or, you know, something like that. It's great.
Okay. And then another manual focus lens that you might want to consider would be the 105 f2.5 manual focus lens.
Right. And a little bit larger.
And a little bit slower maximum aperture.
Right.
But still pretty fast.
Yeah, pretty fast. And just that one is a fantastic lens just in every way that I can think of. It's extremely sharp. It does have a higher contrast level than the 85. which means it also works really well for other subjects. And beautiful out of focus backgrounds, you know, just really, really nice. It, you know, that was one of the lenses that Nikon became famous for, really. It was that particular one. And it's great. Also not very expensive. You know, there are tons of them on the used market. And if you're using an autofocus body that will meter with manual focus lenses, you know, it can be a great choice, especially on a film camera.
Mm-hmm. Now that brings us into the autofocus category, and we'll start and we'll work our way up from the shorter focal lengths. There's the there's two 85 millimeter lenses.
Well, let's talk. You mentioned the 50, so let's not ignore those, because those can be pretty nice in certain circumstances.
And I've used both of them.
Yeah.
There was the first 50 millimeter lens that I bought that was autofocus was the non-D AF 50 millimeter 1.8.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we talked about it as a stocking stuffer.
Yeah.
And it's not the fanciest construction. I mean, it's definitely got a plastic barrel, and I think it's made in China.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? It's under $100, or just about $100, depending on, you know, which day of the week. The current version has the distance chip in it, so it's an AFD model. And it's astonishingly sharp.
Oh, yeah.
And I bought it just because, well, I'd have a prime lens. I bought it when I still was shooting film, just because a 50 was always what I had as a normal lens. And so I just figured for $100, why not? And
mm-hmm.
some of the images I've gotten with that lens just blew me away.
Right.
And on a DX format body, that gives you the same angle of view as about a 75 millimeter lens.
Mm-hmm.
So not quite what you get with an 85, but pretty darn close.
Works nice for group portraits, mm-hmm. really. It's a good focal length.
And I've taken some wonderful images with it. And with the 50 1.8, usually by f2.8, it's incredibly sharp.
Mm-hmm.
You need to stop down about a stop to get it to, you know, so
mm-hmm.
To get to maximum sharpness. And then recently I upgraded to the 50 1.4D,
mm-hmm.
which is built a little bit nicer. It's got the little window in it, and it's just a little bit more solid construction, and a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, what, two-thirds of a stop mm-hmm. faster. And it's definitely sharp. It's definitely tack sharp by, at least in my version, the one that I have, by F2.
Mm-hmm.
So I can shoot at F2 and not even worry about sharpness.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit of it lacks a little bit of contrast when you shoot it wide open.
Right.
Is what I've seen. And so you stop, but once you stop down to like F2, 2.8, the contrast is dead on.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times that's fine for portraits, depending how close you are to your subject. I mean, you don't have to shoot at F1.4.
Mm-hmm.
But like you were saying, with portraits, the lack of contrast is not always a bad thing. We've always talked about using like mode one color
mm-hmm.
With the digital bodies for portraits. And mode one has a lower contrast level. So that kind of thing works really great. So those two lenses are very good. They're very sharp and they're very inexpensive. Even the 1.4 is only is about $260, I think, give or take.
But look for both of those lenses on the used market.
Right.
And it's amazing. I mean, you can find 50 1.8s for not much more than the price of the lens caps that you'll likely get, mm-hmm. you know, with it. It's amazingly cheap and a great value.
They're just very good, very mm-hmm. well designed lenses,
right.
Optically.
Now, when you go up, you know, one more step from there, you get up to the 85s,
mm-hmm.
and you mentioned the 1.4 earlier, and that's just a beautiful lens.
Well, that's considered one of the nicest autofocus Nikkor lenses ever.
Or just period.
Yeah.
It's an extremely good lens. You know, it's very sharp. Beautiful rendition of the background, you know, when it's out of focus, mm-hmm. it's very soft and nice, good color.
It just renders creamy,
yeah.
out of focus background.
And it's great now, and it's built well and everything.
Right. It's an older design. It's a little bit older design. It has that auto manual focus clutch
right.
engaged. And I guess my only complaint about it, and this isn't really a complaint, but because it's an older design, it uses a metal screw-on lens cap,
mm-hmm.
which is a little bit less convenient.
You mean hood?
Not lens cap, but a hood.
Yeah.
Correct. And that's a little bit less convenient to use when you got to screw on the lens cap
mm-hmm.
When you're dealing with in the field. Because I like the bayonet
mm-hmm.
hoods where you can just snap them on right. in the reverse position.
But it's not something where you would base a lens decision on.
Absolutely that. Not. I mean, it's yeah. one of the nicest. I mean, it costs a small fortune.
Right.
But darn, it takes really nice images.
It would be nice if it had the AFS focusing motor built into it. But it focuses pretty quickly, actually, mm-hmm. you know, on most cameras.
And so. Generally for portrait work, you're not looking for the fastest autofocus
not
anyway.
Not a big deal. But that's a very nice lens. Now, there's the less expensive 85-1.8, and a lot of times this suffers in comparison with the 1.4 if you're reading things. But, you know, I used to have one. I ended up giving it to a friend, and it's a darn good lens. There's not as much of a difference as people think between that and the 1.4. The 1.4 is a little bit better. It's more nicely made and faster, but the 1.8 is awfully good. And again, you can find some great deals on used versions of that lens.
Yeah, and they're only going to be about a third or so of mm-hmm. the price. Certainly less than significantly less than half the price of what a 1.4
right.
would go for, because the 1.4 has such a great reputation.
Yeah.
It's even the used ones sell for a good amount of money.
Yeah, but it's a very good lens. It
I
really
used
is.
The 85-1.8. I had it loaned to me at the Rich Clarkson Sports Workshop because mm-hmm. I was going to be shooting indoors in a gymnasium where they weren't going to let us use a flash, and it's challenging no matter what you're doing. And so I wanted the fastest lens that I could get, and that was what they had. They had an 85-1.8, and I used it, and it worked quite well. Mm-hmm. I mean, not the fastest autofocus. Again, doesn't have AFS focusing. A little bit, it has a little bit of chromatic aberration,
mm-hmm.
more so than I see in the 1.4. But nothing that is so bad that you'd be not able to get rid of it in post-production or post-processing.
Right.
But again, for incredible value, really,
right,
for that length. Now, the other two lenses that we're going to talk about are these are ones that I don't have, but you have at least one of them, or both of them. Should I have even guessed?
No.
Yeah, it was probably dumb.
And I've got a third one for you in this category too. Okay. We'll come back to.
But these are the DC mm-hmm. Nikkor lenses, and that stands for what, Rick?
I don't remember. Defocus control.
Defocus control, that's right.
Yeah.
Which is a really bizarre term. And they come in a couple of flavors, but the one you've got with you today is the 105 F2
right.
DC.
Right.
And there's also a 135 F2 DC. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty similar.
Mm-hmm.
They're the old style with the manual auto clutch, and they have an aperture ring on them.
Right.
I like they have an integrated hood, which mm-hmm. is kind of neat. If you've never seen these, are the metal hood that slide out, and you can disengage them and engage, which is just great because you never lose the hood that way. And then there's this extra ring on here that it says defocus image control, and it's got the apertures listed on it in two directions. So it kind of looks like the little aperture guides that you'd get with the on the focus scale mm-hmm. on your lens, and you can push a little pin and you can move this to front or back. So you can, what it does is, if I'm correct, it changes it slightly modifies the plane of focus. Is that, or the,
well,
or the depth of field? Is that how it's working?
What it's changing, I think, the amount of spherical aberration and when it does that by, you know, adjusting the lens elements, the intent is it will either increase the amount of blurriness in the background or in the foreground. And you can take your choice by setting the defocus to foreground.
Right,
or
there's an F and an R label rear. On mm-hmm. there, so you can turn the
And dial. You align it with the aperture that you're using.
Okay.
Now, I'll tell you, this is an interesting little feature. Sometimes you'll read descriptions of it that imply that by using this, It you can almost blur the foreground or background independent of the aperture, you know. And I've seen references to, you know, one that I remember reading was, you know, removing the bars, you know, let's say at a zoo in front of an animal. Mm-hmm. That by using this control you could do that. Well, I learned something about the photographer that wrote that, and that he never used the lens. It doesn't do that. It's an incredibly subtle thing. And sometimes you'll see things that say, well, you can't see its effect really by looking through the viewfinder, you can hardly see the effect looking at the images too. It is very subtle.
Okay, so why would you want this lens then?
Honestly, one, it's a very good lens. It's a very sharp lens, both with the 105 and the 135. They're both fast. They're well made. The manual focusing action is very nice. And the way that I find that defocus control is truly useful is you can use it as a soft focus lens. You know, by exceeding the aperture that you're shooting at on the control, it actually turns it into a very nice soft focus glamour lens, you know, for fashion and portraits and things like that. And given that the primary purpose of these lenses is portraits, that's a useful thing. I don't find the defocus control thing to be very helpful. I mean, I've shot test shots with it on and off. Is there a difference? Yeah, but boy, it's slight. It is slight.
Yeah, you know, I played with one once and I couldn't figure out what it was doing because I couldn't see any difference.
So I would not invest in a lens for that reason. There are lots of other good reasons, but that wouldn't be the one I would recommend.
But if you're looking for a good 105 or 135 millimeter portrait lens, mm-hmm. these are some of the best out there.
Right, right. Now, on a digital body, you know, current digital body, D3 will be different. I find these a little bit long. Mm-hmm. They'll work, you know, especially the 105 and even the 135, you can. It's just a different kind of portrait than most people think about. You know, with the 135, it's almost like a 180 equivalent. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, could be used on film bodies for some nice portraits, but, you know, a little bit different kind of shot.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned a third one. Mm-hmm. And the third one that I was going to throw out is the 105 VR macro lens.
Oh, right.
Right, because you're talking similar focal length. It's got a very nice rendition of the out-of-focus areas. Correct. And this was a problem with some of the previous macro lenses, like the older 105 or the 60. They're just not very smooth in the background.
And that's where the VR suddenly becomes useful.
Exactly.
I mean, so we've already debunked that the notion that you don't use VR for macro, you
right.
certainly can,
right.
but it becomes very useful in a portrait kind of situation.
Right. Now you've got a lens that's great in a couple roles, not just macro, but also portrait. So I'm looking forward to using that lens more for that kind of work because it really will be nice with the VR feature mm-hmm. and the fast focusing motor.
You mean on a D3?
On a D3. Yeah.
Well, we'll just have to wait to hear your report on that one. So that's
I think you'll have a report on that one too.
Yeah, well, we'll see. And then our next podcast will be how to justify these purchases to your spouse.
Well, that's a whole show in itself, right?
It could be a whole series of shows. And 'cause guys, we don't have the answer. Now let's talk. We'll move on. That's our portrait lenses for review or discussion. Yeah. I should say it wasn't really a review. Find one that works for you.
Yeah.
You know. Now let's talk about what it means to have a style, mm-hmm. a shooting style, a style.
Photographic style.
Yeah. And
personal style.
And I have to admit, that's not something I ever even contemplate. You know, it's just, I think you realize you have one after you've taken pictures for a while and you
right.
start looking back, or like we were doing before we sat down to record the podcast, and we started pulling up each other's web galleries and kind of looking at, trying to figure out what our style is, and style is more than just how your pictures look,
mm-hmm.
and that's certainly a component of it. But style includes a whole bunch of things, and we just rattled off a list. I'll just start with the list first, and then we can go into
And part of the motivation for discussing this topic it's partially a reaction to all the product oriented things that we've discussed lately. After a while, we get tired of them too. So,
right. I mean, at some point, you have to think about this is a podcast about photography.
Yeah.
And the equipment's only part of the equation.
Right. But also, I think thinking about what your style is and how it's changed over time, how would you like to stretch it, can actually be a help to you in honest to God photographic terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can get you off of dead center or, you know, make you think a little bit more about, you know, your current approach.
So the elements of style,
mm-hmm.
to quote the book that was
right.
writing though, style involves your composition,
mm-hmm.
but it can also involve the subjects that you shoot.
Right.
It can involve the equipment that you use, the locations that you choose, your shooting height, the way, you know, the,
yeah. Do you shoot down on the ground? Do you shoot at eye level? Do you vary it around?
Do you choose black and white color? How do you post-process your images if you're a digital photographer?
Right.
Or even, you know, some people, like in the old days, the cross-processing of films. So all of those things can go into a style. And,
you know, and just think about it in terms of photographers that are probably well-known to you, you know. How about the difference in photographic style between someone like an Ansel Adams, you know, black and white, heavy use of, you know, probably red filters to darken skies and a lot of post-processing, you know, darkroom work to really bring out certain look in the image, versus a Pete Turner, you know, a famous Nikon photographer, predominantly color images, very saturated. You know, he was doing a lot of stuff, you know, prior to Photoshop, you know, to enhance the color of the image, and very graphically oriented, you know, completely different, both great photographers.
Right.
You can look at their photos and say, you know, that looks like a Pete Turner, or that looks like an Ansel Adams. And if it's not, it's someone, you know, closely mimicking their style that they invented.
So expanding on our list here, how can equipment affect someone's style? You know, that usually it comes down to not about what camera that you use, although it can, because the formats, you can use a medium format camera, like you have your 6-4-5 Pentax, or, you know, do you shoot view cameras, or do you use a DX camera, or some people even do things with cell phone cameras,
right?
You know, if you really wanted to.
Right.
But also then the lenses that you choose, like we were talking about, the focal lengths that you tend to pick, the ones that you find pleasing, that will have an influence on the way your images look.
Mm-hmm.
I know that when we do landscapes, you know, we tend to use a lot, but you tend to use longer focal lengths. In some situations where other people might be using wider focal lengths, it's just what you try to do. And, you know, compressing elements in the scene can be achieved through using different equipment. Do you shoot handheld, or do you shoot with a tripod? Do you go for razor sharp images? I mean, Ansel Adams was known for wanting to have absolutely everything completely sharp. And it was kind of a backlash against that impressionistic style. But are you more of an available light handheld? And if it's a little bit blurred, so what? And for some images that convey that sense of motion, that's perfectly valid. You don't need to stop everything crisply frozen in time. So that all of those things can be influenced by the type of equipment that you choose. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be able to shoot 8 frames a second with a 8x10 view camera.
Right.
You know, so, right. I mean, there's certain limitations. Nor would you want to hand hold one. And then we can talk about location. Do you normally shoot where you live, things around the house, or do you shoot do you always travel to go places? You know, someone like a Bob Crist, I mean, he does travel photography. You don't see that many photographs of his backyard, although I'm sure he's got them. You know, we know about Bob Crist's images because it's always something like Easter Island or some exotic location. What else can we talk about with respect to location? Just your choice of time of day and stuff that you choose to do, the kind of lighting that you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you tend to do most of your shooting midday? You know, that's got some challenges, although you can do some good things then. Are you a early morning, late afternoon photographer? Do you use a lot of artificial lighting, you know, flashes to supplement your,
filters,
natural light?
You know, color filters or polarizing, all of those can go into your style, because like a polarizer, like we've discussed, can really change the mood of a photograph. You know, two images of the same subject at the same time, one with and without a polarizer, can give you a very different very different look. Your choice of subject. Now, I mean, that's certainly where it comes down to, you know, one of the defining things of my style, I think, is I like to do portraits of animals. So, you know, my subject matters tend to be nature, wildlife types of things. That's why, you know, we like going on ANPATS. I mean, right. those are right. the kinds of right. you know, landscapes, wildlife, outdoor types of subjects. If you look at my photography on my website, you're not going to see a lot of pictures of buildings.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say I don't like doing that. It's just I haven't, you know, I prefer doing other stuff.
Right.
And
then, you know, conversely for me, I enjoy doing wildlife photography. That's not quite as strong of interest for me, although it's there. I like the landscape stuff. And one thing I really like too is the travel photography. Mm-hmm. I definitely grew up in National Geographic and I love the images that you see in that magazine and the style that of general photography that's in there. And so that's definitely something I've gravitated toward, you know, just attempting to get close to it.
Yeah, and that, you know, really defines what you do.
Yeah, but one thing I think is helpful, you know, one of the things that we kind of kicked off our discussion prior to the podcast with is just looking at each other's images and just giving some thoughts on things that we were seeing. What were some of the things that we saw in common, you know, with the images? For example, when I was looking at, you know, Jason's images, you know, one of the things I mentioned to him, you know, certainly the wildlife portrait aspect was there with, you know, fairly tightly composed mm-hmm. wildlife shots, not the ones with expansive areas around the animal, but, you know, more of a tight crop of the image coming in pretty close, you know, much like you might see with typical portraits of people. Mm-hmm. Same kind of
look. Yeah, I mean, one thing I know is I like to see the detail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm always amazed when I get the images back and I can see details. Look at that, every little feather. Mm-hmm. You know you really nailed the shot when you can see that. Well, the right. only way you get those is those tight compositions. But even my landscape shots tend to be that way, especially yours too. You've done a lot. We were looking at your landscape images mm-hmm. from last year's AMPAD in the Smokies, and there's a lot of tight crops,
right.
a lot of use of longer focal lengths to get compression of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, this is that whole topic of composition. You know, how do you compose
right.
a shot? Do you always bullseye your image?
Right.
It can work. If you listen to my interview with Vincent Versace that came out a couple of weeks ago, if you haven't, you should download it and listen to
That's
it.
That's right.
There's a new podcast out. But he was actually noticing in his images that the subject would be in the center of the frame. A lot of times they were right in the middle. And yet you never had that feeling that he bullseyed the shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was nothing wrong with that. And very, very good. You know, the composition just worked. So there's no rule that says you have to put the image, you know, the subject in, mm-hmm. you know, any one spot. But one thing I've noticed in your shots is you do a lot of stuff that has, you get a lot of good, strong elements in your composition with lines and converging lines and contrast, and, you know, whether it's clouds or it's buildings and shadow, and you've got a lot more of that than I have in my images. And that's just because we're different.
Yeah.
So
that's one of the reasons I think I like the longer lenses a lot of times in landscape situations where, you know, just like on the previous AMPAC, you know, we'd be standing in one spot and I found I was, you know, one of the few people using like a 70-200, you know, just see things a little bit different, I guess. But I like the patterns mm-hmm. and the graphics. And for one, that's one reason why I think I do a little bit more black and white than you too.
Right.
That same interest going there.
Yeah. And before we talk about that, you know, one of the things I know about, like, from my, you know, when I do landscape shots is that, you know, I really made a conscious effort the last couple of years, starting with the, first AMPAD I went to in Rocky Mountain National Park when you were there
mm-hmm.
was starting to use the super wide angle lenses and getting prominent foreground elements in them,
mm-hmm.
you know, really do that. And some of the shots that I got from Mount Evans really got a lot of positive comments from some of the folks at work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they look at my pictures, they always think they're oh, those are really nice, because, you know, I bring some of my pictures in. We mm-hmm. all do, you know, but some of those Mount Evans shots where there was like really strong foreground elements going all the way back to the mountains with the snow on the top of the ridge line there drew some of the most positive comments I had gotten mm-hmm. about those images. So, you know, I certainly like to get low when mm-hmm. I'm doing, because I think everybody shoots at eye level and everyone's used to that.
Yeah,
it's not wrong. It's just what I like to do.
No, but it can lead to a certain sameness. you know, in photos. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've talked about, you know, the tip of getting down at ground level and getting really close to your foreground objects. And I, you know, still think that's a great way to go.
You know, so that can be part of your style. I mean, one thing we certainly know that is, it's hard to do is to discuss and figure out what your style is on your own.
Right.
That's why it was so useful that we pulled up each other's websites to look at kind of some of our sample galleries. You know, these mm-hmm. are the ones that are on our website are generally the ones that we like. So
at least at the moment.
The
it kind of changes. Jour.
Now you were mentioning black and white, and that's something that I haven't gotten back into very much, but I need to start doing that more. But that's a whole different way of seeing,
mm-hmm.
and it really emphasizes tonalities more than it emphasizes
shapes and lines and
so that could be your style if you'd like to do interest. And then with all of the array of digital black and white conversion options that we've talked about in the past, you can really do some interesting stuff without having to shoot black and white film.
Right.
And that sort of brings up the whole idea of how do you post-process your image? Because how you choose to post-process an image is just as much your style as what you composed in the viewfinder in the first place.
Yeah.
And now we both tend to like images that are saturated but not over the top.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people who really go, you know, kind of extreme on the
right.
on the saturation. But, you know, we like colors to have some pop but not be crazy, not
right.
look artificial. I also tend, at least when I post-process, I try to make my images look as natural as possible. That means I'm going to sharpen them, but I'm not going to over-sharpen them.
Right.
And going back to when you took photographs, and this with film, this is what I've noticed. My digital images are all a heck of a lot sharper than the film images were.
Mm-hmm.
And the film images I took at that time were considered pretty good. You know, there was nothing wrong with them. They were sharp. I can get a sharper image with digital. So sometimes trying not to go over the top with the sharpening routines is something that I try to incorporate.
Yeah. But, you know, going back to one of the things that you were mentioning is it can be difficult at times to see, you know, the style or the common elements in your photos. And it's useful to get a friend to take a look at them, just to talk about them. It'll make you a little bit more aware of what's working for you and what isn't. And, you know, a personal style can lead to a lot of success, like with the photographers that we were mentioning earlier. But you also want to not have it inhibit your shooting too. And so sometimes it's useful to say, hey, that's what I do well and I do frequently. Let me do something deliberately now to stretch out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we've talked about some exercises in the past for, you know, stretching out of your current personal style. But, you know, just to recap a few of them, sometimes it can be an equipment-oriented thing that you do. Like if you tend to shoot a lot of things with a telephoto lens, take a really wide-angle lens with you and take only that on a shoot and force yourself mm-hmm. to use only that lens. Simplification in equipment can sometimes be a fantastic thing in order to learn and stretch your viewpoint, right?
Absolutely.
Or if you never use flash, like I don't use it nearly as much as I should, you know, going on a shoot and trying to use it as much as you possibly can. That would be a great thing for me to try, which I haven't.
Yeah. All of those things are excellent ideas.
And, you know, only shoot black and white.
Your style should be a product of what you do. It should not be a limitation to what you can do.
Right.
You know, it should just be the end result is that if you sum it up and you look at all your body of work, there might be some sort of commonality, mm-hmm. common themes running through it, but it shouldn't constrain you. You shouldn't say, well, I'm a macro photographer, so that's all I'm going to do.
Yeah. But, you know, a recommendation, get a friend that's a photographer, you know, that's reasonably knowledgeable, to take a look at some of your images and just give you some feedback on them.
And
have
there's
them help identify those common elements. And
there's some
things.
Other options you can do. If you don't have a friend who's a photographer, that's why the Nikonians community exists. There's some forums.
Virtual friend.
You can have people, you can post images in the positive critique mm-hmm. forums or the picture I took forums or mm-hmm. wherever, and you post your images and ask for the feedback. How could I have improved this? Or what mm-hmm. do you see? You know, what am I doing here? And not to say, you know, what's wrong with my pictures, but
right.
just to say, what could I have done differently with this picture?
Right.
Maybe they're both would have been equally.
Yeah. And because, good. You know, asking for criticism is a tough thing for a lot of people because they're afraid of what they might hear, you know, ease into it. If you want, you know, start with, you know, just requesting some comments on, you know, what do you think about my style? What are you seeing as common themes? You know, are what are the ones that the shots that are more successful and what are the attributes about those that made them more successful?
Yeah, and the people at on the, for the most part, one of the reasons why I like the Nikonians community so much is that most of the people are
very civil,
really nice.
Yeah.
And you know, we have some really good moderators in those forums who do a great job of giving positive feedback. You know, I don't think anyone's going to go in there and tell you that you shouldn't be a photographer
yeah.
and throw away your camera.
Yeah.
You know, so, and if they do, that's just mean spirited. You right. should report them. But
now, I will say if you ask for a critique and you get back a comment that says it's a nice capture, that means, try harder.
It's because I couldn't think of anything really outstanding
right.
to think of.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people take post-processing completely over the top and make that their style.
Yeah.
I've seen some stuff where they use filters to, you know, completely, you know, make these high contrast images or where everyone's skin looks plastic, you know. It's weird to me, but that's not
It can
wrong.
Be very cool, too.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've seen that. So find your style. Sometimes you have to go back and look at what you've done over the last, you know, couple of years. Go back to your archives of stuff and look through your images and say, what is it that I really do?
Yeah.
Because photography is such a diverse subject that, you know, there's no one right answer to this,
no.
to this question. And it's just an interesting way of looking at your pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's talk about one last thing before we leave, and that's our weekly prescription.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a prescription for solving problems with lightweight tripods.
Yeah, and a lot of people are using fairly lightweight tripods anymore. You know, the carbon fiber ones, as an example, all tend to be pretty light in weight. They're stiff, but they're very light, and there can be a couple problems with that, right? Now, you were mentioning an obvious one.
The wind blows over your tripod.
Yeah, and that's I've had that happen to me, too.
Happened to me when we were up in Mount Evans. Thank goodness my camera wasn't on the tripod.
Well, I've had it happen to me with a camera on the tripod. Fortunately, it landed in soft grass, but I've had that happen a couple times. You get a good wind that comes up, and if your camera and lens combination is fairly large, it's just like putting a sail on top mm-hmm. of your tripod. And if the tripod is light, it'll just go right over. The other thing with a lightweight tripod is, you know, when that mirror comes up and you're taking exposure and it's a pretty good whack, certain shutter speeds, and we've talked about this, you know, with mirror lockup, it'll just kind of resonate.
Especially with your longer lenses.
Yeah, and so if your tripod is a little bit lighter, you can see more of that effect. Now, a really simple, low-tech way around this is if your tripod has one of those hooks on the underside of the column or plate, or whatever, take advantage of that. If you're carrying around a bag or a backpack, hang it from that hook.
Provided that you don't overload your tripod.
Right, right. Usually you won't. And that will put a lot of additional weight. It'll dampen out the resonances and things like that. And it can really help with sharper photos, and it can keep your tripod from blowing over. For example, I was in Shenandoah National Park last weekend. And for a couple of days, and it was a little bit windy at times, so I did that trick, and you know, not only did I get slightly sharper photos without having to use the mirror lockup, but I didn't have to worry about my tripod blowing over because it actually was that windy at times. So it works well. It's cheap and easy. If your tripod doesn't have that kind of hook, sometimes you can buy accessories, you know, different adapter plate, you know, for the tripod head or whatever, that'll include one of those.
Yeah, I know for a fact that Kirk makes some replacement plates for like the Gitzo tripods that don't come with a column.
Right.
They have a hook underneath them, and I'm pretty sure you can get those in the Nikonians Pro Shop, actually.
Right, along with Marken's plates that do exactly the same thing and have a hook also.
So that's a good option. I'm going to seriously contemplate getting one of those because they're still pretty low profile.
Mm-hmm.
For those of us who bought a tripod that doesn't have the center column.
Yep.
Well, that's a great suggestion, Rick, as always. So if you've got a suggestion for a prescription or a show topic or just want to drop us a line, please send us your emails to talkradio@nikonians.org, and we'll be sure to get back to you as soon as we can.
Yeah.
And thanks again for listening, everyone.
Yeah, I think for our next podcast, we're going to try to do a little bit of live stuff from the AMPAT.
Or at least
right?
have some reporting from the AMPAT.
Yeah, at least that's our intent. We'll see if we follow through on that or not.
Fortunately, I'll have my laptop. We can record on it. All right, excellent. Well, we'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.